What happens when a 20-something cold caller discovers he can turn greed into gold? Jordan Belfort's transformation from lower-than-pawn scum to the Wolf of Wall Street reads like a fever dream of American capitalism gone mad. His first day at L.F. Rothschild in 1987 introduced him to a primal truth. The boardroom at Opening Bell wasn't a workplace. It was a gladiatorial arena where young masters of the universe screamed into phones, creating what Belfort described as a mighty roar of unbridled greed. Senior broker Mark Hanna delivered the industry's fundamental lesson over lunch. People don't buy stock, it gets sold to them. This wasn't investment advice. It was a declaration of war on unsuspecting investors. 6 years later, Belfort had built Stratton Oakmont into a machine that would make over 1,000 people rich beyond imagination while systematically defrauding countless victims. His mansion, helicopter, and second wife, the stunning Duchess of Bay Ridge, represented the ultimate American dream. But this dream had a dark engine, teaching socially awkward kids to sound like financial wizards while peddling worthless stocks to people who trusted them. Think your workplace is intense? Stratton Oakmont redefined corporate culture entirely. 1,000 employees, mostly under 30, chased the life in custom suits. Rookies made $250,000 their first year. By year three, they were millionaires. Even switchboard operators earned $80,000. The system was elegant in its deception. Stratton specialized in IPOs for shell companies and penny stocks, orchestrating classic pump-and-dump schemes. Brokers targeted wealthy investors first, creating artificial momentum before pushing stocks to retail investors. At the center sat Janet, Belfort's executive assistant in perpetual black, managing everything from his schedule to payments for prostitutes. Partner Danny Porish cultivated shock value, famously swallowing a live goldfish to enforce discipline. The culture descended into calculated depravity. Female assistants earned $10,000 for shaving their heads. Drug-fueled parties featured prostitutes and midget-tossing competitions. When Forbes published a scathing 1991 profile calling Belfort a twisted Robin Hood, the firm threw medieval-themed parties where brokers dressed as knights. This wasn't spontaneous excess, it was strategic. Every outrageous act reinforced loyalty and created shared complicity, binding employees through mutual transgression. As millions accumulated, Belfort turned to Switzerland's legendary banking secrecy. Meeting banker Jean-Jacques Sorel at Union Bancaire Privé, he learned the dark foundation of Swiss discretion. During World War II, Jewish families fleeing Hitler deposited savings in numbered accounts. When they perished in concentration camps, Swiss banks erected bureaucratic walls against surviving heirs, accumulating billions from genocide while building their reputation on secrecy. Modern regulations eliminated truly anonymous accounts. Belfort's solution was Aunt Patricia, his wife's elderly British relative, a retired schoolteacher with a rebellious streak. As a non-US citizen, she could exploit Regulation S, a loophole allowing foreigners to bypass the mandatory 2-year stockholding period. Belfort enlisted Roland Franks, a master forger specializing in bearer corporations registered in tax havens, creating untraceable transaction chains. Physical cash smuggling involved Todd Garrett, a martial arts expert turned heart transplant survivor, turned America's largest Quaalude distributor. Todd, his Swiss wife Carolyn, and trusted associates developed sophisticated transport methods using specially designed body harnesses and modified luggage. When Aunt Patricia died, the master forger reassured Belfort, "There is no finer nominee than a dead person." Belfort maintained his family man image while consuming enough drugs to sedate Guatemala through masterful compartmentalization. His wife, Nadine, transformed their Long Island mansion into nouveau-rich paradise. $9,000 Disney mobile, horses despite severe allergies, full household staff. She declared, "I love you to the point of madness," yet he harbored doubts about their relationship. His addiction became elaborate choreography, timing Quaalude doses around Nadine's schedule to prevent drooling or slurred speech. When offered 20 genuine Lemon 714s, he paid $500 per pill. Within 9 months of son Carter's birth, cocaine became his primary substance, beginning each day with a precisely measured gram, his sardonic breakfast of champions. Sleeping only 3 hours weekly by mid-April, his paranoia reached dangerous levels. He fired shots at an innocent milkman, mistaking him for a federal agent. Carter's diagnosis with a serious heart condition briefly provided clarity. Through his children, Belfort experienced true unconditional love for the first time. But these moments proved fleeting against addiction's overwhelming force. In January 1994, the Steve Madden IPO netted Belfort over $20 million. He settled with the SEC for $3 million and a lifetime securities ban, which proved meaningless. He kept an office near Stratton, advised Danny, and invested in new issues, essentially becoming his own rat hole. Attorney Ira Sorkin called it a complete victory, since most brokers had lied under oath, leaving no smoking gun. But FBI Special Agent Gregory Coleman was obsessed with taking down the wolf. He connected Todd Garrett's cash-stuffed briefcase arrest to Belfort's Swiss money smuggling. When Jean-Jacques Sorel began cooperating, it created a dangerous link to offshore accounts. As walls closed in, Belfort's personal life imploded. During a cocaine-fueled rampage, he threatened the Duchess with a butcher knife, screaming, "I'm James fucking Bond looking for microfilm." The breaking point came when he grabbed daughter Chandler and announced he was taking her to Florida. As the Duchess chased him, he kicked her down the stairs, threw his unbuckled daughter in the Mercedes, drove through the closed garage door, and crashed into a limestone pillar. A bodyguard rescued Chandler. This wasn't the movies. This was a father endangering his child's life while high on drugs. After his arrest, Belfort fled to Florida with $50,000 in drugs, ending up at the Solid Gold Strip Club with 18-year-old stripper Jenny. Through cocaine and champagne, he professed his love before guilt overwhelmed him. Friends and family refused contact unless he entered rehab. In desperation, he poured 50 morphine pills into his palm and began chewing. His friend Dave tackled him, wrestling the pills away while calling 911. At Delray Medical Center's psychiatric unit, staff pumped his stomach with activated charcoal, leaving him retching and handcuffed under Florida's Baker Act, a 72-hour involuntary hold. Talbot Marsh Rehabilitation Center became his turning point. Despite initial cynicism, Belfort embraced AA's principles. After 3 weeks, the Duchess responded, "For better or worse, you're still my husband." His first sober summer brought genuine friendship as former Stratton associates vanished. But FBI agents soon swarmed his estate. The Duchess declared, "I don't love you anymore." The U.S. attorney threatened to indict her unless Belfort cooperated. To protect his children's mother, he wore a wire and testified against his friends. Everyone faced justice. Danny served 20 months, Victor Wang 8 years, Steve Madden 31 months, Elliot Lavigne 3 years, Dennis Gaito 10 years. Belfort and the Duchess eventually fell in love again, but with other people. After rocky relations, they shared custody peacefully. Belfort served 22 months in federal prison. His story mirrors capitalism's darkest possibilities. What happens when ambition untethers from morality, when getting rich becomes the only religion? The Wolf of Wall Street was defanged, but his howl echoes as a warning. The American dream, pursued without conscience, becomes America's nightmare.